Hi, this is Steve Rubin. Welcome to the Criterion Collection's audio commentary on From Russia with Love, featuring director Terrence Young, editor Peter Hunt, and screenwriter Richard Maybaum. This first sequence, the famous gun sight logo designed by Maurice Binder, features stuntman Bob Simmons, not Sean Connery. Sean Connery later entered this sequence when it was redone for the CinemaScope Thunderball. Now, the first sequence we're going to see in this movie is called a pre-title sequence, or a teaser. And this was introduced with this movie. Dr. No actually featured credits first and movie second. This sequence was based on a movie called Last Year at Marienbad, which was inspirational to director Terrence Young.
This was entirely stolen. I just seen a very pretentious picture called L'année dernière at Marienbad, where everybody was wandering down moonlight paths with sculptures and Christ knows what. And so we put Sean in there. This is all L'année dernière at Marienbad, all this crap. Sean wore a very funny makeup there. He had a very strange... That is Sean, actually, himself with this weird... They put a kind of a plastic makeup on him, you know, to make it look like it was a... You could, to explain the mask that they lift off him at the end.
Editor Peter Hunt was assigned the task of shooting inserts for this very moody sequence.
It was shot with the actors, with Terrence, and then we needed to make it work a little better and pick up a few things. And again, as I said before on Dr. No, the value of a few inserts, such as the feet walking along and up the steps and around there, and that we did separately. That I went off with a second camera and cameraman and shot those separately. Just close-ups of feet to give it some suspense, which was good. It all worked. All these lovely master shots were done by Terrence, of course. In fact, this is the garden of Pinewood Studios.
And I made one of the stupidest things a director could do. I made one of the stupidest mistakes. When he pulls the mask off, you see James Bond, and James Bond is killed before the picture even begins. After they've killed him, they pull off this mask, and there's a guy who looks just like Sean Connery. And we didn't realize this till we showed it at a preview. So I then had to go back and make a picture of the guy who looks nothing like Sean Connery, you know, because otherwise you really are disturbing the audience. I mean, the whole gag, the whole trick had gone out. And it was just, as I say, stupidity on my part. I just had to shoot the close-up again. Fortunately, I didn't have to shoot the rest of the stuff. That's all I need to do. Now we came to credit titles. We were late with the picture. UA tried to rush the picture forward, and we didn't have time for Maurice Binder to do his normal things.
Now, these titles were devised by a Canadian gentleman, but these were not done by Maurice Binder, actually. This was the first time that this sort of projection onto a background that was removing had been done. Since then, it's been done a great deal. That is, back projection, and projected onto it was the lettering through various optical prisms, so that they became distorted and then at some point became clear. They had to be carefully organized so that you got the clear point to read it sufficiently. Well, that was all done for real. That was all shot by Brown John, his name was, the guy who did devised these titles. This was all shot with sort of a back projection lenses on a black screen and foreground action.
That's her waggling her fanny. I said we'd have to project these things with an ordinary, which we did, with an ordinary... you know, like slide projector, like you have in a school thing. And all we did is we projected these things against the body of the and photographed. And it's very effective. This we shot naturally at the very end of the picture, you know.
In 1983, I met a cinematographer named Frank Tidy, who worked on this original sequence with Robert Brown John and Trevor Bond. And he told me that the idea came when Mrs. Brown John walked in front of a slide projector they were using one day. And that became the basic idea for the titles. The in-joke on this title sequence was that they projected Ted Moore's credit, the cinematographer, over the girls behind. And the producers were very pleased with the sequence, and they brought Brown John and Bond back for Goldfinger. After that, Maurice Binder, the original title designer, was brought back, and he's been used ever since. Now we come to a hallmark of the Bond series, the use of exotic locations to introduce important story elements. The first location from Russia with Love is Venice, where we're introduced to a very interesting chess match.
Yes, well, this is, again, another piece of opening sequence which sets the style. Again, also, and I'm not sure you've seen it very much since we made this film, you know, the idea of an international chess match played in this way in Venice is unique, which makes it very interesting as a piece of filmmaking, a piece of storytelling.
This other chess player, the great chess master there, this chap, he's a Pole, Ledikshiba. Wonderful face, great eyes, very sinister. I wish Kasparov and Karpov played as quickly as these two geezers do. Most of that's a mat. We only built the tiny part of the height of the chessboard. All the rest is painted. He came, our casting director just proposed him, and he came and I saw him and I grabbed him straight away. Didn't ask him to read or anything. Just the face was what I wanted. Good actor, this man, such a good actor. I've used him about 3 or 4 times.
You know, in a strange way, it has quite a suspense about it, although we don't really know, you know, what this chess game represents at this stage in the story. But the way that it's put together and the way that it's been shot is very suspenseful.
As I told you once, when I originally said I'd make 3, I said, or when they offered me the first picture, I said, as long as it's Thunderball, From Russia with Love, or Dr. No, as I told you by one of those weird quirks, those are the 3 I made, but in reverse order. I always thought From Russia with Love was the best of all the Ian Fleming books. I think it's the only one that really is more or less foolproof as a story. All the others, when you analyze them, they're really like the plots of those old Republic pictures, you know. And I think it had far and away the best cast of any Bond picture. It had Robert Shawn, his first big international picture. It had that wonderful John Ford troupe actor, Pedro Armendariz, with Lotte Lenya. It really was a very, very good cast.
I needed an establishing shot. Now, that's the reverse of the shot where she gets up at the end of the sequence. It's done in the labs. You just reverse the film. Now we go to Blofeld and the famous fighting fish, which they gave me to shoot, of course. The wretched fish wouldn't fight. And in fact, I made it up of a lot of very short cuts when they got together, so that it made them just using the bits where they did actually come together. But there was feet of material that, in fact, they were just swimming around. You only have the hand stroking the cat. Now, that's the shot I reversed. We never actually showed Blofeld in any of them. That was Anthony Dawson who did it. It wasn't Anthony Dawson's voice. I put Anthony Dawson's voice is a little different, a little less sinister. And I put a very famous actor who's died now. All the earlier Blofelds, the voice where you don't actually see the actor, was done by Eric Polman. This is a very interesting sequence because it was shot a couple of times for various reasons of dialogue. And in the end, those close-up shots of Lotte Lenya were done against a frame from some of the original material as back projection. But the way that they're put in and edited in, you'll never know. We just used a piece of the picture, and in fact, if she moved at all, you'd see her behind on her own, which was a piece of a take that we had previously done. because we altered the dialogue later on. There she is in front of herself again. That background there is in fact the back projection. But it fits in very well. You have to be a little careful about the editing of it and making it all smooth and work. But then that gave us the ability to change some of the dialogue, which we did way after. After we got practically the whole film together, we suddenly realized that maybe she shouldn't be saying this, she should be saying that. Now, rather than put it into her mouth and make it look all untidy and ugly, let's just get her and do a close-up like that. And take a frame from one of the original pieces of the film that we shot, because we haven't got the set, and Charlie Stafford will back projection it for us and put it onto a screen, and then we'll shoot. And the cameraman matches the photography, and boom, there you are, you get it, without ever worrying. And the audience shouldn't know, actually. It's a secret they shouldn't know, because no audience should be sitting there looking for a thing like that. They should be listening to the dialogue, following the story.
That was Tony Dawson's hands.
I shall put my plan into operation straight away, and there will be no failure.
We're shooting in the garden of what was the country house. That's Pinewood Studios. It's about 25 miles outside London, so it's nicely in the green belt, in the country, as it were. So you've got a lot of openness around you. And there's Black Park right next door to it, which we are always using for exteriors, which is a big open park with lakes and trees and anything you want there. I did the titles for Chitty Chitty Bang Bang there, recreated it as German. I have been at Pinewood since I was 16. I love working at Pinewood. I found it's a very nice studio. It's a very... Like most studios in England, they were country houses originally, and Pinewood also was a country house, which gradually grew and grew and grew into a studio.
She was about 70 then, and she was screwing like mad when she was about 80. She's a great lady. I used to have lunch with her every time I came through New York, and it was very interesting. She was married to Kurt Weill, you know, the composer, who wrote, amongst other things, Mac the Knife. Walter Gotell, I discovered him, this big chap here. He's never out of work, playing Russians or Russian generals or German generals. I don't think there's been a Russian film made without him. He speaks a little Russian now.
Producer Harry Saltzman, who came up with the idea for the teaser sequence, actually wanted to film it on this set, with Bond being chased through the obstacle course by Grant. But that idea was killed because they wanted to save this production value for this later sequence.
Oh, this was very good. This was just a set, again built on the back lot of the studio. Just a walk through, and that's the same shot again, done from a different angle. But another reason for carefully editing it, just giving it a little bit more production value. Though that's good production value too.
Call him.
Grant! You see, Mr. Shaw looked quite a splendid figure of a man by then. I made Robert Blyard blonde his hair. He very nearly turned the part down because of that. Well, he said, you'll have to get another actor. So I said, well, we'll get another actor. And then about 2 days later, his agent called and said, he's dyed his hair. Can he come and have lunch with you, sir? And he looked wonderful. And I sent him to a gym because he didn't have a very good physique. But my God, he did after this.
He seems fit enough.
They bloody nearly killed him in that gym. He was doing about 5 or 6 hours a day. This is perfect. We had a crew in Istanbul for about 2 weeks trying to find all the best angles. And we spent weeks and found them all. I then went to... This girl was Miss Europe, Danielle Bianchi. Nice girl. And in the end, in the hotel, I found the identical... Every setup we had was already on a postcard. So now I've learned the lesson that when I take a crew there, I first buy the postcards and we send them out to try and see if we can still get the same angle or improve on it, you know.
She's a very pretty girl. Unfortunately, she can't walk very well. And if you notice, I've chopped most of her walks. She has, of course, the legs under the table that we're going to see are not hers. She has an unfortunate, rather splayed foot walk, which doesn't, I didn't think, look very attractive. So I just managed to snip off. You don't see very many. You had to see that one. You see where she comes up. But you're not conscious of it. But if you held her for too long, it became evident, I thought.
This was an old caravanserai where the caravans used to come, and the animals would be billeted down below, and the camel master and everybody would sleep in these rooms like a hotel. That place was about 700 years old.
There is a lot to get across in this film, of course, and it's very cleverly concealed behind very atmospheric material and developing character. I mean, this lesbian character of Lotte Lenya in this film is very well done. It's just there, but it's not unpleasant and it's not obvious, it's not in bad taste. It's in extremely good taste. This is a set that was built in the studio. The only location part of this was her arriving at the in that slope and with the shadow of Robert Shaw following her, watching her.
Lotte Lenya, who was known mostly for her singing career in her husband Kurt Weill's compositions, such as Three Penny Opera, was signed to play Rosa Klebb, a terrifying character who screenwriter Richard Maybaum describes.
Well, Lotte Lenya was a freak. She was the kind of impersonation of female villainy, just kind of concentrated evil. And at the same time, Terence Young kind of softened that a little bit, because at least she had some, not fellow feeling, but she was obviously moved by Daniela Bianchi when she was walking around in back of her and put her hand on her shoulder, and you knew that there was something there, and that the girl had evoked in her some lesbianism perhaps or something like that. You see, that would seem to me her only redeeming feature as a person, but she was marvelous.
Contrary to the uniform, Rosa Klebb is a member of SPECTRE, which in Ian Fleming's parlance stood for the Special Executor for Counterintelligence, Terrorism, Revenge, and Extortion. Now, they're the principal villains in this movie, but that wasn't the case in Ian Fleming's original novel, which featured SMERSH, the Russian organization, as the principal villains. When they came time to make this movie, the producers decided to stay away from a political context, and they made SPECTRE the villain, an organization that was created by Jack Whittingham, Ian Fleming, and Kevin McClory in Thunderball. Here's James Bond's introduction in the film, which curiously comes 18 minutes in.
Now, this is what could be a better introduction to James Bond than boating on the Henley Regatta, on the Henley River.
Bunting. I couldn't agree with him more.
I may even give up golf for it.
Oh, really?
This is great fun. And at the same time, it has that sort of air of sophistication about it. And unfortunately, this is the only film, I think, where you actually see the Bentley, the green Bentley, which Fleming wrote about so much.
Sean was just starting to put on weight after this. 2 weeks in Istanbul, he had to hold his gut in when he was getting out of a shower or something. This again is one of the pieces of James Bondia that Fleming wrote. Don't you remember the old Bentley? They chucked it away and they put an Aston Martin and a Lotus and everything in between. It's my shirt he's wearing, by the way, because I didn't like the shirt they had, so we switched shirts on the set.
He is not on his way.
31-year-old Eunice Gayson reprises her role in From Russia with Love as fetching Sylvia Trench. According to Gayson, her role was going to be a running bit in the series. However, when director Terence Young left the Bonds during pre-production on Goldfinger, her part was eliminated. As you recall from Dr. No, it was to Sylvia Trench that Bond uttered his first line of dialogue. I admire your courage, miss.
Now, about that line.
Now we come to James Bond's second favorite indoor sport, hat tossing.
This was my gag, and he became awfully good at it. I told you, I was practicing throwing the hat myself, waiting for Sean to come on the set, because he was late in makeup or something. He saw me and he tried it about 20 times without it working. But the very first take we did, it worked. He said I was only fooling before. Now it's for money.
Again, the same set, of course, which had been kept, pack-struck, as we call it, and the dispatching of him onto his case. I think they've still got, in fact, M's office pack-struck at Pinewood. The sets that they were obviously going to use in other films that they were shooting, they would keep, basically, and put them together again and patch them up, make them work.
A native of London, Bernard Lee appeared in the first 11 James Bond movies until his death in 1981.
That you went out to Istanbul.
Bernard Lee was marvelous. His it was a kind of a slightly paternal relationship, which was very good. Not much, but he was like a very, very strict father. Poor fellow, he died too soon.
The boy who was the armorer in Dr. No decided that he'd rather do 5 days' work in Germany on a small picture than stay with this. And Desmond Llewellyn was in a film I made called They Were Not Divided. He and in Thunderball, there are three more survivors from that film who are all in. So was Peter Burton. He was in it. So was Christopher Lee. Moneypenny, she did her first film with me. This was the first of the gadgets, really, I suppose, this, because it's a Deus Ex Machina thing, literally. It's the thing that saves his life in the fight in the train, you know. Peter Hunt did a very funny gag when we showed this picture to United Artists. We cooked this up for them because they were all very solemn and serious, and Arthur Krim came over and they were so excited to see the show. So when Sean does this now, we had him do the thing, and we then cut to the explosion of the big fortress and Dr. No, and the end title came on. And they said, but what's happened to the rest of the picture? I mean, that's absolutely true.
And as a joke, we played all this exactly as it is now, with Q coming in and saying about the powder box and all the whole thing, and I'll show you what happens. And he says, he goes in here like that. You shut the case up, and if you turn the lock this way, then when you open it, it'll be okay. But if you don't do it that way, and you open it, it'll blow up in your face, or in whoever's face, so that it makes it a secret thing. You see? Like that? Now you're all right. All right. Now M says to him, okay, you try it. And he does that. And he does that, and I blew up the whole film. And we put the end titles up. Dum diddle dum 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 dum. Well, I thought Terence would fall out of his seat. Anyway, he loved it so much. It was a joke. He loved it so much. He said, don't change it, don't change it. And he kept wanting to show it to all sorts of people. Those are the sort of fun things that we did in the cutting rooms.
This, of course, became one of the great themes throughout the pictures, Miss Moneypenny and Sean. She was a wonderful, beautiful girl, and they were so lucky to get her.
I've tried everything else.
Darling Moneypenny, you know I never...
She was crazy about him, of course, and he just kind of kidded her along. And I'll tell you the secret of the world, he'd whisper in her ear.
And they clicked, these two. I mean, they had this little... bandage that worked, you know. And we did all these little gags. These weren't in the script. This thing happened by accident. The intercom, we left it on and we heard a prop man or something swearing next door, and that's how we got the idea. It's my handwriting, by the way. I always write my own thing. I wrote, and my writing is more or less legible. This is Yaslokov Airport. And I live just down there, that white building you can just see. I moved out of the main block and moved to that hotel. As I told you, within 3 days that I was there, Ian Fleming moved in with me, and then Sean, and then Robert Shaw. So in the end, we had practically everybody back to square one. I'd gone away to get away from the actors, you know, to be alone. Everybody had their wives with them, and I had my wife, and so they were all quite happy.
Until they go wrong.
Exactly.
I'll get the car, sir. Thank you.
This is the guy, I tell you, who looks like Pedro Armendariz. And I didn't reckon, I was so stupid, I should have got something with blonde hair or something. But we put him in that black beret, and that seemed to do all we needed.
The similarity in style that director Terrence Young brought to both Dr. No and From Russia With Love is apparent in this airport sequence, which is very similar to the one in the previous film. In this case, the Jack Lord character is replaced by a Bulgar killer and Robert Shaw as Red Grant.
Well, Russia is more more realistic than the others. It just almost could have been true. We hadn't gone so far yet into the the fantastical, I might say. It was believable, almost believable. Well, as I would say, it was entirely believable. Real people in a real situation. And also there, too, a very, very beautiful love story about this girl that's come over because of this crazy yen she has from being a fire closure and because of this picture and all that kind of stuff. And the story and the girl herself was so beautiful and so gentle and so pleasant. She's almost my favorite girl, although by far not the best actress. I think the best actress of them all was Diana Rigg in On Her Majesty's Secret Service. But I liked the love story there, and I also liked the action. It was believable.
Oh yes, there was a marvelous girl in this, a Yugoslav girl, yes. This girl now, coming out now. She's wonderful to wear a hat flops off. Rather gorgeous girl. The inference being they've been screwing, you know, with Pedro. This is the first sign we realized that Pedro had cancer when he started limping in this sequence.
You're in the Balkans now, Mr. Bond.
He hadn't told anybody about it at the time. He needed the money.
We don't make it too difficult to keep a tab on each other.
Wonderful man. Marvelous chap.
He's a rather intelligent young man, by the way. He should be. He's my son.
But he does resemble a lot, you see, the other man, you see. And, you know, these clever directors don't think of things like that. He got the job because John Ford called me and said, look, can you give him a job? And I said, my God, we never thought of him. We've got just the role for him. We hadn't cast him. So I said, what are you paying him? And Jack lied through his teeth. He said, we're paying him $100,000. He was getting $50. But Jack knew that he was sick. And he wanted to leave some money.
I'm wasting my time here. And so do I. This is an old friend of mine. And it tells me something smells.
Maybe. But if there's the chance of getting a lector. Now you tell me, where can I contact this girl?
She said she would make her own arrangements. You'll just have to wait. Ah.
Thank you. My friend, if you really want my advice, you should spend a few pleasant days with us here in Istanbul, and then go home.
It's the British Embassy Rolls Royce, yes. Such a photogenic city. That's Bob Simmons, by God. Yes, it is. He used to do the stunts and all that. Nice chap. He died last year. No question. He's more assured in every way, you know. He was a little too eager in Dr. No. Now he's cool. When you analyze it, he was the first really cool star in the business, you see. I would have said already in Dr. No, there's signs of it, the things, and that was Ian Fleming, and then again what we added to the script. The humour we gave, that kind of flip humour, gave a sort of impression that, you know, he didn't care, that he was above such worldly problems. Do you have that in America? It's bad luck to put your hat on the bed. Sean never knew that. You don't know it. That's very bad luck to put it. That's why he hesitates, and he says, oh, screw it. You know, I don't give a damn. Macho man, you know. I'm above such things. Already in this now, everything he does is with such assurance. He doesn't panic there. They're bugging his room and all that. And the first one, he got a little bit frantic about those sort of things. Now he says, well, hell, you know, I'm better than that. I'll find it. What the hell? So he moves to another room. He's a fly boy. He was about his most comfortable in this picture. You know, he looked good. He didn't put on weight, and he was very proficient already playing the part. He got into the skin of the part, you know. I mean, it's a thing that he was... By the time we came to this, he had much more confidence in what he was doing, you know, naturally. He was suddenly a major, major star in the world, you know. And you could see the development. I mean, his playing of comedy and all that is... There are one or two scenes in Doctor No where he goes over the top. It's my fault. In this picture, you never had to tell Sean what went wrong. I'd say cut, and Sean would say, okay, I'll get it right this time. And he did. We always had a girl and doing the desk clerk, whatever it is. If a girl could do it, a girl did it, and especially a pretty girl.
Well, let's have a look at it. I may like it.
The porter will show it to you. He will be up
That's
immediately.
Lovely little actress called Yvonne. In fact, is married to Leslie Bricus.
The desk clerk's voice was dubbed by an actress named Nikki Vanderzil. If you listen carefully, it's the same actress who dubbed Ursula Andress' voice throughout the entire Dr. No film. Now we come back to cold-blooded killer Red Grant, portrayed by Robert Shaw, who unfortunately died at a very young age. He was a terrific actor. He was born in Lancashire, England on August 9, 1927. Some of his early films prior to From Russia With Love were The Lavender Hill Mob, Operation Secret, and a movie called Sea Fury in 1958, which also featured Francis DeWolf, who will be the gypsy leader in a scene coming up. Grant must have impressed the producers of the movie Battle of the Bulge with this film, because they cast him again as a ruthless blonde heavy.
There again, that's a perfect postcard. There are about 6 million postcards of that shot. That's Sansa Sophia. Well, here's this gorgeous, what's her name? She's saying, aren't you going to come and screw me? And he says, wait a minute, I've got work to do. Da, 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 da. She was married to an immensely wealthy chap. We only discovered this afterwards. Both shots show her best developments. But we wanted somebody who looked vaguely Turkish, and Yugoslav is pretty close to the border. So. This was such a lovely man. I adored him.
That's Nadja Reagan, who once again appears in the next film, Goldfinger. She plays the flamenco dancer Bonita in that film's teaser. She's the girl who Bond is kissing when he notes the approach of an assassin in her eye pupils. Pedro Armendariz, I would have to say, is my favorite character actor in the entire series. He was born in Churubusco, Mexico on May 9, 1912. He began to gain recognition in films directed by Emilio Fernandez, including Maria Candelaria in 1943 and The Pearl in 1945. European and American directors, notably Luis Buñuel and John Ford, sought out his services, and his strong screen presence was effectively used in a variety of roles in more than 75 films. Who can forget his memorable performance as Sergeant Beaufort in John Ford's Fort Apache?
Well, who won?
I had visitors. Limpet mine on the wall outside. Time to catch me at my desk.
It is believed that Pedro Armendariz developed cancer while working on the 1956 film The Conqueror, which was shot near the Nevada A-bomb test sites. The disease would also claim Armendariz's fellow actors John Wayne, Susan Hayward, Agnes Moorehead, and director Dick Powell. The son of Pedro Armendariz, Pedro Armendariz Jr., was seen in the 1989 film License to Kill. It's the only time in the Bond series where a father and son team are featured.
Here again, you know, we started all these lovely scenes which were put into extraordinary places and whatever we could find locally to make it more eerie and interesting. This was, in fact, the sewers under Istanbul. This is a great waterway under the city of Istanbul. We put the sound on. I mean, what sound was there? As you can imagine, poor sound crew, they didn't get much chance. It's very echoey. So virtually the sound was put on. It was post-synced so that we could get the right sounding dialogue, and whatever atmosphere we put on, we made up afterwards.
This was one of the first days when I knew that Amadaris wasn't well. We had a lot of problem with him in his bloody boat because water was dripping from condensation. The rats were never in it, actually. We put the rats in as a bit of embellishment. But I knew there was something matter with him because he kept getting so irritable. He kept saying, "This water's going in my suit." And I kept saying, "Well, for shut up, Pedro. I mean, of course the water's going in your suit. It's going in my suit. It's going in my hair. It's going in my mouth." That's what happens when you're down in these places. He went upstairs in between to the next setup and all that. When he came down, he was just happy as a sandboy. What had happened is, like, let's not mention his name, a studio boss who's having a conversation with you goes out because he isn't making any sense, takes a big sniff or two and comes back and there's a ball of fire. He was taking morphine when he went out because he was in pain. And it made him very irritable and bad-tempered. The moment he went up and gave himself a shot, he was fine. The man looks like Khrushchev. You know, that Brezhnev saw this picture three times, because when I went and I met Brezhnev, and they explained who I was, and he said, and they said, yes, he said, First Secretary wants to tell you that he has seen the picture, but he hasn't seen it officially. I said, well, how did he get it? He said he got it from the British Embassy, because it really isn't anti-Russian when you analyse it. That was Ian Fleming's thing. That was Ian Fleming's idea of the periscope.
And the whole idea of this, which is rather lovely and Bondian. We call it Bondian nowadays. I mean, in its time, it was just an ingenious idea that a submarine periscope should be hidden right into the Russian embassy conference room. If you start to analyse it, it's a little hard to take. But the film is so believable that you enjoy it. You take it as part of the story.
The girl comes in. We had to get the girl with the best legs. We went to a model agency to get a pair of great legs for this.
Well, from this angle, things are shaping up nicely.
In fact, this is not Tanya's legs and body at all. This is somebody with nicer legs, actually, and better physique.
Can you give me a plan of that place?
I wish I could.
But there must be the original architect's drawing registered somewhere.
I'll get on to that.
The object of all this cloak-and-dagger activity is the Lector decoding machine, which was referred to as a specter in the original Fleming novel. However, when the screenwriters decided to make Spectre the villains in this film, they changed the name of the machine to the Lector. It was based on an actual decoding machine used during World War II, the famous Enigma decoder, which helped win the war when Britain's Ultra Organization broke the German diplomatic code in 1939. The truth about Ultra, the Enigma, and Ian Fleming's part in its activities wasn't revealed until 1975, when British wartime secrets were first declassified. Now we come to the Gypsy Camp sequence, which begins in a rather playful mood, but quickly becomes one of the better action sequences in the series.
Well, this was the Gypsy Camp. I was out two nights ago with one of the wrestlers. This was the cowardly, that was the cowardly stuntman. He wouldn't jump out of the Anita Ekberg's mouth. This was Pedro Amadaris' last day of work. That's a double. He couldn't walk, he could hardly walk at this time. And talk about luck. We shot on a Saturday and a Sunday because he was leaving on the Monday or the Tuesday. No, we shot the Saturday night. And we shot the Sunday night as well, that's right. And I just finished the sequence. I did his last shot and the rain started to fall. It rained for about 5 days. If it had rained then, we'd be absolutely screwed. Because he had to go back to hospital he'd got a date at the Cedars of Lebanon. That's the place where he committed suicide.
This is all done on the back lot of time with this gypsy camp. We had a great sense of problem with the gypsy fight, the girl, two girls fighting. It was considered to be rather immoral. In fact, at one point during the... I had to appease the British censors, certainly, and I think various other censors, because they thought it was far too sexy and immoral, the whole fight. And at one point, I remember the British censor telling me that he could see the girls' pubic hairs. And I said to him, if you can, I've been watching it frame by frame on the Moviola, and I can't. If you like, I'll show it to you on the Moviola frame by frame. And if you can see anything like that anywhere, I'll cut them out right in front of you.
I wish I could do that. Those kind of muscles, I think, take years of development.
Sean Connery's comfort in the James Bond role is clearly evident in these gypsy camp moments. Sean Connery won the role of James Bond because of two films he did in the early 60s. One, a Disney movie, Darby O'Gill and the Little People, was seen by producer Albert R. Broccoli in Hollywood. The other film, Operation Snafu, also known as On the Fiddle, was seen by Harry Saltzman in London. It's believed that these two films convinced the producers to bring Connery in for his first interview.
Yes, she really was a belly dancer from one of the Turkish restaurants or Turkish nightclubs, I think, in London.
Now, Sean in the first one would have shown much more animation than he did in that one, you know.
Sean's so good. If you watch him, you just look at Sean alone. He's extremely good, the way he looks at her.
Tell our host his hospitality overwhelms me.
That fellow played the big gypsy. He's been in several of my pictures. He was in Triple Cross.
Deborah.
They don't do women fighting very much in films today, do they? Like The Wicked Lady and those things that they used to do out of England in the 40s and 50s.
Kandavanoza betirnis artik, enende sonunda, resimisen, ulula kemin, even a jene karar, vere bilsinle.
The elders of the tribe will then decide who in the end will marry the chief's son.
Kudamuz, Zora.
She's saying that.
Yes, I think I got it without the subtitles.
We spent quite a bit of time, several different occasions, shooting this, I know, and doing some pick-up shots and various, put it together and cut it together and then worked at it a little bit more and then went and shot some more of the girls fighting. I have a feeling Terence enjoyed doing this fighting, these two girls going at one another. Apart from being an excuse to get a rather nice piece of unusual sex into a James Bond film. But it's interesting to think that they thought this was rather risque in those days. And when were we? 62, 63?
That was in the book. But in the book, and Ian was very disappointed because in the book they're stark naked or very nearly naked. And one of them bites the other's breast, bites a nipple or something. I said, Ian, what kind of a picture? You know, how the hell did you expect I was going to get away with that, you know? They hated each other also, which was a great help. Their dresses came off without us trying anything, really. One of the tops and one of the, but anyway, but even then we had a lot of censorship problems with it.
What's interesting about this gypsy camp battle is the opportunity to see James Bond display his marksman skill. There's quite a bit of gunplay in this sequence, something that was not a hallmark of later films in the series.
That's a double. Poor Pedro, you did very little in it. Marvelous man, I have to tell you, really, really marvelous man. You know, it's very rare to see an actor who can fire a pistol without blinking. What I used to do with a lot of them is advance the soundtrack about four or five images so that the bang happens before he actually fires. Nobody ever knows. And at least his eyes are still open at that moment.
it's a good action sequence to edit. You make the most out of everything you've got, and you hope that you've got a lot. Or the more you've got, the better you can make it, and the more you can break it up and turn it into a sequence of events so that it has some sort of beginning, middle and an end. It always helps in any action sequence if you can get the sort of smoke and the fire and the gunfire, or each one of these incidents, which are of course shot separately, and the time they're all put together like this, you can make it very exciting. This was an extremely successful film. Everybody thoroughly enjoyed it, and so they should have done. It's a very, very well made, very beautiful story, and very well done. And it deserved to be very successful because of everything about it. But if you asked audiences, and I remember some interviewer do so as they came out of the cinema, what it was about, what was the story, they always fumbled. They never could tell you the straight line of the story. And if you really think about it, it's very hard to tell the straight line of the story. And furthermore, there's a great inconsistency in it. Why do they go by train? What's wrong with getting on a plane? But if you didn't go by train, you wouldn't have had the film.
I think it's the fact that I was an American writer and tuned to the pace of American pictures and American action pictures that kept moving them along. And I think that if it had been an English writer, and there were some English writers on the thing, the pictures would have not zipped along as quickly as they went. I gave it a kind of a tempo that I think prevailed throughout the entire series. I think an English writer might have been a little more leisurely. I don't know, it might have been better, but it would have been different. Would not have had the pace and the tempo that I insisted upon having. If you look at my screenplays, you'll see how clipped and terse the dialogue is. And that, fortunately, was maintained even when somebody else was doing the screenplay that was set. And we didn't know at that time really how good an actor he was. You know, we thought he was a big, strong fellow because he'd been in a few shows where he played big, strong fellows and kind of quiet and so forth. But we didn't know that he was that good. And we didn't know that he did have a kind of a mischievous, impish kind of side to him, too. I won't say that, but being a Scotsman, he kind of had a dour humor to him, too.
21-year-old Jamaican actress Martine Beswick portrayed Zora, the gypsy girl in the red dress. She would return two films later in Thunderball as Paula Kaplan, 007's assistant in Nassau. Now, the following sequence features the famous Call Me Buona billboard. In the original Fleming novel, the billboard was from the Marilyn Monroe film Niagara. And the assassin actually crawls through Marilyn Monroe's mouth.
Oh, yes, this was Istanbul. We had the secret police with us. The secret police, you can tell who's a secret policeman. He wears one of those raincoats that touches the ground. I mean, really, literally, it's as funny as that. It's like a uniform. And we were having a lot of trouble with the people on the street because it's meant to be 3 o'clock in the morning, nobody on the street. And they kept coming out. We had about 50 cops there, and they couldn't do anything. And two of the birds arrived from the secret police. I had an absolute identical situation with the mafia doing the same thing when I was making Valachi papers in Brooklyn. And these two guys came in there, and they just went up to the first four people, and they went like this, were standing outside. They put them in a car, and they took them to prison like that. Everybody thought they would never see them again. They came crying, saying, "Help us." We said, "Don't worry, they'll be back in the morning, don't worry." But everybody got in, and nobody came out for about 2 days after that. They were still staying in the house. We got them out in the morning, you know, but they might have kept him in there for a few months, you know.
One of the unsung heroes of the early James Bond movies was cinematographer Ted Moore, who was an ex-RAF fighter pilot. His skills are apparent in atmospheric sequences like this one. Moore had been with Terrence Young since the 1950s, when they worked on films like They Were Not Divided and The Red Beret. Ted Moore would work on 7 of the first 9 James Bond movies.
We had just finished that film, you see, when we started this Call Me Buona, that is, with Anita Ekberg. He comes out of her mouth. And producers, never being backward in advertising their own material, if they were going to have a hoarding up there, it was going to be Call Me Buona, which was one of their films, which was great. They put that poster up there, very voluptuous Anita, and they put the window right where her mouth is. Again, a wonderful piece of inventiveness. And there's a window there, you'll see it open. That they did in Turkey.
The chap we had, he wouldn't do the fall. He said it's too far. It wasn't such a big drop, it was about 40 feet. That's another actor.
That pays many debts.
She should have kept her mouth shut.
She should have kept her mouth shut, that's right, yes. A lot of our funnies we couldn't use that were so obscene and dirty. Or we'd giggle and we'd say, come on, let's think of something to say. And one of us had come up with something.
They eventually became sort of nice little flip lines. We eventually made, of course, as you know, as the Bonds went on, they kept inventing them and putting them in. But they actually slipped out. There are one or two in fact, Minnows Pretending They're Whales is almost the same. But little things like that in Dr. No, and then a few more came in From Russia With Love. Number of them were put in by Terence at the time of shooting. Not necessarily were they all scripted, or they came out of the situation as they were shooting it. And then, of course, eventually they became the pattern and scripted later on.
Now, here's a very interesting thing. Everybody says, what happened to the bath? Why didn't it overflow? Now watch. The reason it didn't overflow is he never puts the plug in.
And another reason it doesn't overflow is because if you look really carefully, there's no water coming out of the faucet, just steam. So we needn't have worried about it in the first place.
I had to tell him to keep his stomach in because he was getting very overweight at this time. He had a definite paunch. Overeating, Sean loves to eat. But a lot of censorship problems with this sequence, this next one. Well, she was naked and they said, oh, you can't do that. And in those days, they didn't even like the idea of people screwing on the screen, you know. Normally you expected to cut away, to pan away to the fireplace, you know, to the embers or, I don't know, to something else. There were a lot of very nice clichés we used to have in the cinema. Waves breaking, white stallions jumping in the air. Shaw looked rather good there. Very handsome.
I suppose for 30 years ago all this was very sexy. I don't remember that we had very much trouble with this, censor-wise. I think they just all got so excited by it they got carried away. I hope. I got to know him very well, and he was a very reasonable man, really. He was really a very nice man, but I got to be quite friendly with him. And he liked to have a couple of martinis, and the producers used to say to me, go on, Peter, you take him out to lunch and show him the picture. And I used to enjoy showing him the picture and having lunch with him, putting a few martinis in him and making him mellow and nice. And he was basically very reasonable. There was a great deal of problem about the gypsy girls fighting, that there was a certain amount of displeasure over that. They thought that it was so near the knuckle at one time, and we had to play around with that. But in the end, it resolved itself, and I took a few frames out here or there. It didn't make any difference, really. But basically, we didn't... I mean, we didn't go out of our way to make anything salacious or so bad. We tried to keep the whole thing in as good taste as we could.
I will tell you.
Today you could show it in a Sunday school. I mean, you know. Actually, really, when you analyse, it's only in about the last 5 years that it's really been, the floodgates have opened. I mean, take a film like White Palace. I mean, the physical act is performed about 4 or 5 times on the screen. We even had a problem here where they're photographing through the invisible mirror, you know, the two-way mirror. We were saved by the fact that I went back and I did a shot of the guy mopping his forehead, so they laughed and they said, that's not dirty. If you're doing it, I mean, oh, it was so charming. The worst censorship was in America. England was not good, but America was ludicrous. When I made Moll Flanders, we made 84 cuts in that picture. And I didn't understand the film when I saw it. You see, he does look so like Pedro Amandaris. It was such a stupid thing on their part.
Approaching the most interesting corner of Saint Sophia.
And the little guide here was a real guide, and he was screwing his blind. But when I went back there many years afterwards, he was still doing it. And he got me these carpets for about a quarter of what they really cost, but they were really worth about one quarter less still. Marvellous. That was originally a Christian church that was built by Constantine. Mr. Anthony Sinclair again. And my shirt maker, Mr. Lanvin. And that's how I wear my handkerchiefs always, like that. I don't like what I call actors' handkerchiefs, where they all flop out like John Barrymore used to. Oh, they were so happy to have us make this. It was the first big picture ever made in Istanbul. They were tickled sideways, especially after the success of Dr. No, you know. And they found out something that it was terribly good for tourism, this.
Very well photographed, I have to say this. Ted Moore, great compliment to Ted Moore, because it must have been extremely difficult. I think they had more time on this movie. They did have more time. They had a longer shooting schedule than they had, and of course they had more money to spend on this movie than they had to have by its nature too, than they did on Dr. No. So it by virtue of that, there was perhaps more coverage being able to be done. And who knows, by then I was getting to be a better editor than I was on Dr. No. And making it all smoother. Although smoothness is not really the point of editing. The point of editing is to make the sequence work as a whole and get across what you're trying to say. Nowadays they do the most outrageous things just to get across whatever point it is they want to make. They don't care any longer. Once upon a time we used to try and make everything go smoothly so that the audience was not aware.
All I know is that it saved me the job. Once he'd seen the girl, she was obviously compromised, and so...
And he wasn't killed because of that.
There's a sequence in the film where, I can't remember, it's all so confused now and it's such a long time ago, but I know the man in the black beret, who is the Bulgarian killer, he goes into St. Sophia's, and Mr. What's-his-name puts on his black gloves and kills him, or breaks his neck or strangles him. Now, we had a little scene before Sean arrives on the ferry boat to meet the girl who's going to give him the Lector machine. And the question is, how did he get away from all of them? In the end, we never bothered, but we cared a lot about it at that moment to make it more logical. How, when he's being followed, we've said in the picture, they follow us, we follow them, we're all very respectful about it. How did he get away? So they had that big Rolls Royce that he arrives in, and Sean is in the Rolls Royce. He's followed by the man in the black beret in the Citroën. Now, I got it wrong. Sean is in a taxi on his way to the ferry boat. He's followed by Mr. Blackberry and the Citroën, who is followed in turn by the big Rolls-Royce, the British Embassy Rolls-Royce. At a certain moment, Sean leans across, jams on the handbrake, the car stops, Mr. Citroen runs in the back of him, smashes his fender, smashes the front, and crash into him from behind comes the Rolls-Royce, which starts to pull away, and out of the Rolls-Royce steps Pedro Medeiros with his cigar. And we did 11 takes because we want him to have his ash intact. So at last we got it. Third one, and out steps Pedro Medeiros looking very urbane in a pale grey suit, looking very smart. And the man turns on him and said, "This is unethical. This is against all protocol. We never do this amongst ourselves." He said, "You've smashed up my car." He says, "I can't move." And Pedro had the cigar, and he said, "My friend," top, spills the ash. This is James Bond, the same thing. He says, "My friend," tap, the ash on the thing. He says, "That's life." And he gets back in the Rolls Royce. Sean gets in, and they drive off with this guy stranded. And they didn't have car phones in those days. The night that I heard that Pedro had cancer, my brother was the Queen's surgeon, and I sent him to see my brother. And my brother said, "You realize this guy's very badly ill. She's got cancer." So I called him and I said his wife had flown over because they, you know, it was now getting serious. My wife invited them all out, me at dinner in the Dorchester. And while the girls were parking their things, I said to Pedro, nobody knows how to say anything in a thing like this, but whatever you'd say to me in the same condition. He said, "That's what I'm feeling for you right now." And he patted me on the shoulder and he had a cigar in his hand and he said, "That, my friend, is life." And I was always awfully moved by this thing. And we had that sequence in there, and that's the sequence I told you, my 10-year-old son. The picture's been shown to everybody. The critics have seen it. The United Artists people have seen it. The French distributors have seen it. They're dubbing it in French. Nobody realized, and I realize now we should have left it in. Nobody realizes that the guy's already dead. It's extraordinary. What if a picture's moving fast? I'm sure everybody would have noticed it on the way home.
"Oh, James, will you make love to me all the time in England?
Day and night. Go on about the mechanism."
This was a revamp of Dr. No's set. After which they got so rich they couldn't care less. They just tore everything down, just built it again. You know, they threw money around like drunken Indians. You know.
Here's a technical blooper.
"Oh, once when I was with Anne in Tokyo, we had an interesting experience."
In You Only Live Twice, Bond says he's never been there.
First time I met Amadaris, my wife, I wanted to shampoo my hair, and there was a bottle of shampoo there. So I put it in my hair and shampooed it. Then I went and shaved. While I was shaving, I noticed my hair was going red. My wife had red hair. It's one of those rinses, shampoo rinses. So I was hysterical. This was a Saturday morning. I've now got red hair. So I rushed to a hairdresser's, and he said, "That's all right. We'll dye it black for you." So I went in there, and they dyed it black, but it went sort of black-green. So now Pedro Amendaris meets me for the first time at the Connaught Hotel where he's staying, and it's one of those things. He can't take his eyes off my hair. And finally I said, "Look, Mr. Amendaris, you must get one thing straight. I'm not a fag, and I don't normally go around like this." And I told him a story. He said, "Oh, thank God." He said, "Jack," said, "what a terrific guy you were. You were a prize fighter. You were an all-American football player." And he said, "You didn't kind of look it to me." And I said, "No, I suppose not." But whenever I used to see Pedro, he always used to go like that, say, "Yes, yes, it's all right today. You're okay." It became a sort of running gag. But it was not the best, as I say, introduction with Mr. P.
Screenwriter Richard Maybaum was 53 years old when he wrote From Russia with Love. He had been an honored New York playwright by the time he began his screenwriting career in the 1930s. Prior to the Bond films, he had worked for Cubby Broccoli and his first producing partner, Irving Allen, on a number of offshore-produced adventure films, including Paratrooper, Hell Below Zero, and Zarek. But it was with the 007 character that Maybaum found the perfect writer's medium. It's not surprising that Broccoli chose an American to be the first to dramatize Bond for the big screen. Broccoli's contention all along, even as he and Saltzman were selling the series to United Artists, was that Bond had to possess the qualities that would appeal to an American audience. He had to be a ballsy, sexy, two-fisted adventurer in the Raymond Chandler, Mickey Spillane style. Maybaum knew that character well.
I think that's poor Bob Simmons. Whenever everybody got knocked around, it was always Bob Simmons. Now, this is where they grabbed the Lector machine. And it wasn't much bigger than that. It was just about the size of a portable typewriter, perhaps a little bigger. We had a lot more sets in this picture than in Dr. No, you see, when you analyze it. Sid Kane designed them all. He was a very good art director, as I tell you. He was an extremely good art director. Very practical. That was in the house next to the Russian legation. That belonged to an insurance company. The house of the exterior, that we used the exterior.
Now we come to the rat sequence, which was shot on locations in England, Istanbul, and Spain.
Now these rats, we had to shoot the scene in Spain because the British would not, the health authorities would not allow us to have them in the studio.
The only thing Mr. Fleming ever asked me about From Russia With Love was when he met me during the time we were shooting that, he said to me one question. He said, "Are the rats in?" You know the scene where they this rat stampede in the cellar of the thing? That was the only question he ever asked me, "Are the rats in?" And then, of course, he did say, "Your screenplays are so much funnier than my books." I don't know why. I should have told you, because we tried to make them funnier. And I had the feeling that Mr. Fleming was a bit of a snob. That's all that I felt about it. But a tremendously talented man, much a greater writer than most people gave him credit for, his descriptions and character studies and all those things, simply marvelous, really. And I had and still have great admiration for him.
This is Istanbul Railway Station. Lovely station. Absolutely period. This was about 1905, the architecture.
That whole thing of getting on the train, zooming into Robert Shaw and the train going off, is all shot on location. Now, once we come onto the interior of the train, that's all. This is all set with back projection behind it.
We had a camera crew that went up and down the real track of the Orient Express. And it was the first time, I think, we'd had the triple head projector, you know, which gave it such depth. You were able to shoot with much greater depth and different size lenses for the picture. We did all sorts of tricks, because I'd done another film with Train BP.
Terence was very, very helpful, especially in all the things that we worked on together. He helped a great deal. And I think he is responsible to a large extent for the style of the pictures, and had the greatest influence in shaping them. He's a very, very talented man. I have great admiration for him, and we got along fine. I met him on the first Broccoli picture, which was The Red Beret, which he directed. That's where I met him. We got along fine then. I think I worked on how many pictures with Terence? I don't know, 6, 7 or something like that. But Bonds and other pictures in Bonds. We did one that didn't turn out so well called No Time to Die and so forth like that. When I saw it, I thought it was about time to die. But that was rare.
Honeymoon, and I have nothing to wear.
Huh? Your trousseau.
James.
He was a great ladies' man and liked the ladies very much. But he was not above using them in his work. As a matter of fact, I've written someplace where I say that in the last analysis, his greatest weapon was himself. He could extract secrets from them, win them over to his side, make them change allegiance and all that kind of stuff, just because he was a great play. That was part of the James Bond mystique, that he could manipulate women that way. Later that became a very, very you know, the women's lib people began to hate all that stuff, and we eventually had to do it less and less.
Here, director Terrence Young tells an amazing story that links the deaths of Ian Fleming, Pedro Armendariz, and Ernest Hemingway.
And unfortunately, Ian died after From Russia With Love. She came out to Istanbul. Now, the funny thing is, he'd never been there, although he wrote about it very knowledgeably. He'd never been there before, Isitomia. And he came and stayed with my wife and myself. We'd taken a part of a hotel for ourselves. I didn't stay at the Hilton with the rest of the crew. I like to be alone if I can. And after a few days, Sean and Diana, his wife, joined us. And then after a few more days, Robert Shaw said he was coming. So in the end, we had quite a big mob there. And Ian became, he was a very shy man, which is surprising, but Ian became very relaxed and had rather a pleasant time with us. I must say that I was glad that it was so. I think, I'm trying to remember where I was having lunch at the Mirabelle. It might have been with Sean, I can't remember, when we heard about the death of Ian. It was before I did Thunderball, that's all I remember. It was in between From Russia With Love and Thunderball. He was a very nice man, a very shy man. And I think that's why he was slightly aggressive when he met people and rather arrogant, but it was a shyness more than anything. I was there the first time he saw Dr. No. It was at the opening at the Pavilion Cinema. And he was absolutely elated. Even old Coward was not too disparaging, you know. My dear boy, it's rather a pleasant picture. Surprisingly pleasant, very agreeable, don't you think? And anyway, I think he had a weak heart, which I never knew about. And I think for quite a time he was sick before he died. And in a funny way, I have a silly, creepy feeling that he died in the same way. We were great caviar fans, and we were buying caviar in Istanbul for about, I'm not exaggerating, about 10% of what you paid anywhere else. They used to buy it straight off the Russian ships, and they were buying it, and they were making a big profit too. And I brought a lot of it back to London with me, and when Pedro Armendariz, who I knew was dying of cancer, came to say goodbye, I shot all his scenes in a big hurry in From Russia With Love to get rid of him quickly. Ian was there, and the three of us were sitting on a sofa, and he was telling Ian about Hemingway, who was a great friend of Pedro Armendariz, and how when Pedro had been to see him just before From Russia With Love, Hemingway had grabbed him and said, "Please don't let me go, I won't ever see you again, please don't let me go." And as the boat pulled out, he tried to jump into the boat with Armendariz, and he was big, fat, and overweight, and over everything. And he practically fell in the sea. They had to grab him. He cut his leg. They put him back on the shore, and they said, "You know, Papa, you must go home, but we have to go." And he was telling how he knew that Hemingway was going to kill himself because Hemingway was sick. And he said, "I don't intend ever to be a vegetable." And Armendariz said, "I think that's..." Yeah. Armendariz was a very macho Mexicano. And he said, "That's how a man should die." About 2 weeks after he came back here, he went to St. John's Hospital, I think it was, and he had a lunch appointment with his agent, Paul Kona, Mrs. Kona, and Pedro's wife, Carmen. They were all meant to meet at lunch at the Scandia restaurant. I remember it very well. And about 1:30, he hadn't shown up. They were there since 1 o'clock. And they called the hospital and said, "Has Mr. Armendariz left?" And they said, "Mr. Armendariz is dead." How he did it, we don't know, but he took a shotgun into the hospital and he put it in his mouth and pulled the trigger. Ian was awfully impressed by this. And I remember when we were having lunch just after that, he said, "You know, it's astonishing." He said, "But I could have told you after that lunch that that was the way Armendariz was going to die." And when he almost committed suicide. In fact, he did commit suicide. He swam when he shouldn't have been, you know. He had a nurse there, and the nurse said, "You mustn't swim underwater." And he swam about 2 lengths underwater, and it practically killed him. Like, he was dead within a day or so. He didn't want to be a vegetable either.
Urbane Irish film director and screenwriter Terence Young was 47 when he directed From Russia With Love. He was a contemporary of Ian Fleming, and while Fleming was serving his country as a Royal Navy intelligence officer, Young was a dashing young tanker with the Irish Guards Armor Division. Like Fleming, he was a connoisseur of the finer things in life: gourmet meals, expensive wines, beautifully appointed homes, travel and adventure. Young had been reading Fleming's novels for years, and thus was very familiar with the world of 007. Since he was the first director on the United Artists series, Young was very much responsible for setting the style of the films and guiding Sean Connery in the role that made him an international star. In many ways, Young was James Bond. His involvement with Broccoli and Maybaum dates back to 1954, and the Alan Ladd World War II adventure, The Red Beret, which was called The Paratrooper in the United States. One of Young's earliest films was about the Irish Guards and was titled They Were Not Divided. Why were Ian Fleming's novels so successful? Here screenwriter Richard Maybaum offers his own opinion.
The war was over. Mostly the rationing was over, where they didn't have anything to eat in England. And all of a sudden, here comes a guy who is a gourmet, an epicure. And everybody was so delighted, especially when he was such an upstanding, fine young fellow knocking down all the bad guys, that he had these wonderful qualities of being tonsorial, perfect, and educated, and charming, and having all of these marvelous attributes of a civilized gentleman, at the same time being a brutal, ruthless killer dedicated to Queen Country. That was the attraction. There, it was a getting away from, especially in England, of the grimness and the tawdriness and the terrible grind that they'd had, you know, twice as long as we'd had it in the United States, and therefore he was welcomed as the new man, the new Englishman, and also because we know that England's position in the world has, I won't say deteriorated, but changed in the last 50 years and so. And this was a substitute, a kind of memory of the great past of England's glory. And who better to personify it than this marvelous, wonderful Scotsman? It was, again, the weird thing about it. And also, one of the things why the Bonds have been so successful that the producers were very, very fortunate in putting together a very, very good team right down the line, and they stayed together for a long time. That helped a great deal. Mr. Broccoli was very much responsible for that, and Mr. Saltzman was also helpful. He was a brilliant man. And came up with wonderful ideas.
The very first film I ever cut was The Man Who Watched the Trains Go By. Funny enough, yes. With Claude Rains and Marta Torin. And that was my first job of editing. So I'm particularly addicted to trains.
Helping editor Peter Hunt with the train travel sequences was the Pinewood Studios sound department, which came up with over 300 different sound effects of a train in transit, which helped to avoid the sound monotony of a typical train sequence.
I don't like, I really don't like montage scenes. And it was scripted as a montage, which is going to come up, I think, in a minute, of the train going across, you know, Europe. And I kept putting it off and putting it off. We hadn't got very much material. I'd shot a bit on a map, and we'd done a few train wheels, one thing or another, and I really couldn't think how to make it all work. And my assistant kept saying to me, come on, you've got to do this montage. Oh, yes, I said, I'll do it. And I kept leaving it and leaving it and leaving it until one day he said, you really must do this montage because, you know, the film isn't complete till we've got that. We can't really have a whole showing. Oh, I said, all right, give it to me. And I grabbed hold of it. I said, I'll do the Richard montage. And I put it all up, and I slung it around, and I threw it together, really very sort of angrily, really, more than anything, creatively angrily, if you like. And I said, there it is, that's it. Okay, fine.
mark it up and give it back to him. And it stayed exactly as it was. It was exactly what you see in the film. It worked so well that I was even surprised. You notice the train turns green, but nobody ever worried. That's because that's a library shot. That's a library shot. It's got the red dot in the wheel. I think I ended up with the red dot there, which I put on. That's right. So then that's a green train from the Southern Railway, England. I destroyed the illusion. This is very clever, because he shot that from inside of the train arriving at the same station we were before, but this time we put up Zaglin. We still had to be certainly economical. He's supposed to meet with the counterpoint here, this young man here, well, and that young man was our production manager on the film. Here they are. Now he goes and meets with him. That was young Bill Hill in those days, since become a producer.
Production manager Bill Hill, who portrayed Captain Nash, always joked about his brief non-speaking part. He said, "It was totally preposterous if you thought about it. Here I am arriving in Zagreb station on this terribly important mission to assist a fellow agent. And after we trade the recognition signal, we're on our way to the bathroom. What were we supposed to be saying anyway? Let's have a pee and then we'll board the train?" It was ridiculous.
And I remember Robert and I sitting and talking, and he was worried about what sort of accent he should have because nobody had heard him speak up to now. And then when I saw the dailies, as he goes to get on the train and they meet, they talk, but at the same time as they talk, which is the first time you were going to hear Robert Shaw talk, there's a lot of steam comes out of underneath the train. And I said, we don't hear what you say.
Nash.
The first time we ever hear what you say is when you present your card. And so I devised that so that I made the station noises blot out everything. And it worked. It built him up again a bit more. I have to tell you, I was very friendly with Robert Shaw. We had done a lot of things before he was ever a star. He was always used to do screen tests for girls and things like that. I worked at Beaconsfield Studios, and whenever we were doing tests of people, they always used to say, "Get Robert Shaw, he could do with the work, you know." And we used to get him down, and he was always the guy who had to do the off lines or kiss the girl or, you know, be the actor off. So I had known him for many years, and we had sort of had a friendship, great friendship.
Been long in Yugoslavia?
About 3 years.
Interesting work?
Yes, sometimes. You know how it is, old man.
Native Londoner Peter Roger Hunt was 35 years old when he edited From Russia With Love. As supervising editor on the first 5 James Bond films, second unit director on You Only Live Twice, and director of Honor Majesty's Secret Service, Peter Hunt contributed greatly to the visual style and pacing of the early Bond films. Starting with Dr. No, Hunt and director Terence Young used a film editing technique comparable to television commercial cutting, which produced a very lean visual structure. For instance, if an actor walked out a doorway and headed for his car, Hunt would get him there as quickly as possible. The phrase "cut to the chase" aptly described this type of editing style. Said Terence Young, "We used to cut in the middle of pans. There was no dissolving. You went straight into flash cuts. There were a lot of sound cuts and an enormous number of tracks and pans, so that one always got the impression that something was moving on screen. The result was that if it was only on the way home that the husband turned to the wife and said, 'It was rather nonsense, wasn't it?' But people would qualify their criticism with, 'Look, you enjoy it for a couple of hours. What else do you want?'" The idea of keeping films like From Russia With Love moving at all times is a key to their success. Everyone, including producers Albert R. Broccoli and Harry Saltzman, were concerned that American audiences would not accept a Scottish actor as a leading man and hero. Consequently, much of From Russia With Love's screen time is devoted to movement, action, and fights. Sean Connery has a minimum of dialogue in the first film, Dr. No. From Russia With Love has plenty of action. Peter Hunt's pacing, combined with Terrence Young's precise direction, Richard Maybaum's script, and John Barry's brilliant music, initiated a new style in filmmaking, a style that was carried on by director and former editor John Glenn in the later films. Eager to make his directing debut, Hunt began to tire of the editing chores on the Bond films after the release of Thunderball in 1965. He agreed to return as editor and second unit director on You Only Live Twice only if producers Broccoli and Saltzman would let him direct the next picture. And he did direct On Your Majesty's Secret Service.
Now, lovely back projection plate. That was shot by day, and I put a... That's the same plate that I used for the day sequence, but I put a what's-name filter over it, a dark blue filter, green dark blue filter. And it made a very good... Night plate. And Ted Moore did a beautiful lighting job. You know, there are always these shadowing effects and all that. But the soundtrack is remarkable. There are over 300 and something different tracks there to break up the monotony of tick-a-tick-tick, tick-a-tick-tick, which is soporific and extreme. Someone said that it was Napoleon, I think, who said the British are a nation of shopkeepers, but really they're a nation of sound men. I mean, The Oscar in the last 20 years for sound, I think 15 times has gone to England. You know. It's their nature. It's their... They're much less... And funny enough, recently we've been getting the Oscars 3 years in a row. We had the best camera award. But I've never really believed that they were that interested, whereas they're fascinated by sound. I mean, fascinated.
What was it? The stuff you put in a drink?
Chloral hydrate. Quick, but mild.
And?
Take it easy, 07.
Somebody once said, I can't remember, they said the best fight scenes they'd seen, I'm trying to what the other was, and they said From Russia With Love. What happened was that I went to the studio on the Sunday, and it was not Bob Simmons who was the stunt arranger, it was another guy. But he really did come up with a jolly good thing. And I went there on the Sunday, and I used to be a boxer. And we worked out the whole fight, and we spent the whole day on the set. There was nobody there, just a prop man and an assistant and somebody who kept bringing a sandwich and coffee. We stayed there from about 10 in the morning till about 6 at night. We got it all worked out. And in the morning, when they came on the set, it must have been a masterstroke, but one of the stuntmen didn't show up. He hadn't arrived. So I did the other thing. We did the whole of this fight with a double and me. And when it was all over, I said, I suppose you boys want your doubles, don't you? Yeah, yeah, yeah. And they I think it was Sean said, well, if an old fart like you can do it, he said, I think we can. They did everything in this picture except one. There's only one thing in the whole fight that wasn't the two principles. And I think that's one of the reasons it looks good, because you don't have to cut away in the distance. You can stay close to them because you see the faces and things.
The fight, which is a very good train fight, one of those spectacular things, on which we had three cameras, shot on the stage, beautifully done. But because we had a lot of nice, very, very nice material, I was able to build it into a very good fight. But that's good material, good stunt work, and we had stunt doubles for it as well, and well-devised fight. And it shows you what you can do with it. And a well-cut fight, too. It took a lot of time. It was a very diligent and very... I used to enjoy doing it, and I would go back to it and back to it and back to it. I would put it together, and then I would have other ideas about it, and then pull the shots about and then make it work even better or get more into it. Each time I managed to make it better. In fact, I think I remember fiddling with it when we were actually doing the sound effects on it, dubbing it, driving everybody mad. You suddenly see it 3 or 4 times in the theatre when you're putting some sort of sound over it and you realise, oh, if I'd done that, wait a minute, oh no, let me take that and do that. Then they have to relay up all the tracks and everything, so they don't like you very much. But I'm afraid I got well known for doing that. But the actual fight, we had three cameras on, because it was a double compartment, and we were able to shoot straight on it, as it were, only with different lenses. And we had three, and I was on the floor at the time when we shot most of it. And so we were able to get a lot of very good shots from it, handheld shots, which made it much more exciting. Most of the time, it's far better to do a fight with handheld camera, you know. And also, it was an unusual set to put a fight in on a train. You never had a fisticuff fight, I don't think, before on a train. Not of this caliber. And then going back to the script, you see, it's all been very nicely set up. You know very well, whilst you're watching this, that somewhere that case is going to come into it. Somewhere that talcum powder bomb is going to come into it.
For many people, this is the best sequence in the whole Bond series. Why? Because it's probably the one time you feel that James Bond is going to die. It's very realistic. He's on his knees. He's unarmed. He's staring into the barrel of a silenced automatic in the hands of a killer who will stop at nothing to blow him away. Grant is psychotic. He's merciless. He's not going to take a bribe. How is James Bond going to get out of this situation? Even in the Ian Fleming novel, there was somewhat of a contrived ending. Bond puts the cigarette case over his heart. Grant fires at him. The bullet gets deflected. Bond takes the knife out of the briefcase and stabs him in the groin, and it's all over. The screenwriters took a different tack, and they made the most of it. I say screenwriters because Len Dayton was rumored to have contributed an early draft to this screenplay, and fans of his style of writing say that this sequence has a strong Len Dayton flavor to it. But just listen to the dialogue in this part of the final confrontation, and you'll see that screenwriter Len Dayton, screenwriter Richard Maybaum, and everyone involved in this sequence really created a classic moment in the series.
The first one won't kill you. Not the second. Not even the third. Not till you crawl over here and you kiss my foot.
How about a cigarette?
Not a chance.
I'll pay for it.
What with?
50 gold sovereigns.
Where are they?
Up there in my case.
You show me.
Yeah. What about that cigarette?
Throw him down there. Any more in the other case?
I should imagine so. It's a standard kit. I'll have a look.
Put your hand back in your pockets. Keep them there.
You know, a great gulp of joy went up amongst the public. They said, yes, he's going to open it. He's going to open it, yes. You can hear them saying it around the cinema. So I put out the light as quickly as I could, because that would help this fight a great deal. So the gun goes off, that's right. Now they're in the dark, at least they should be, just the top light. They had knee pads, they had an elbow pads, and that's all.
That's the best fight in the whole Bond series. Shaw and Sean in the stateroom, in that confined space. And it is a fantastic piece of, not so much of stuntmanship, but of direction by Terence Young, to have a small space and to have a fight as exciting and as varied and as interesting and believable as jihad in that thing. That's the best fight in the bunch, that scene between those two.
The realistic violence in this sequence almost guaranteed that it would be edited when first shown on national television in the United States.
God, it is a good fight, I have to say. Oh, so out comes the wire, that's right. To get applause in the cinemas after the scene, it was extraordinary. And we got away with this fight because of one thing, and it was a pure fluke. I added it at the end of the scene. I didn't have a topper at the end of the scene. And what's the name has made him cough up his money at one stage. He said to Sean, just before he kills him, he said, "You won't be needing this, old man," and he takes it. And when Sean's killed the guy and he's lying there and he's just about to leave, he comes forward and he takes back the money and says, "You won't be using this on that." The censor laughed. And on the strength of that, they only made one cut in the fight, just that one thing. Because in those days it was considered a very violent fight.
Even though Broccoli and Saltzman had first seen Sean Connery and Darby O'Gill in The Little People and on the fiddle, I actually remember him earlier than that, in a movie called Tarzan's Greatest Adventure. It was directed by John Gillerman. It was a fast-paced adventure film with touches of a James Bond style, and Connery, even in a small part then, was wonderful. Sean Connery was born in Edinburgh, Scotland, on August 25, 1930. For many, he is the best of all the possible Bonds. He was the first actor to portray 007 in the Broccoli Saltzman produced series, and in one of the screen's true natural resources. Today he's finally getting some of the credit he has always richly deserved. What he brought to the character of Bond was a sense of danger combined with a sexual magnetism that few actors possess. As screenwriter Tom Mankiewicz once said, "When Connery walks into a bar, you know he could probably kill somebody if he had to. When Roger Moore walked into a bar, you knew he probably would say something glib to get out of a situation." Both actors were successful 007s, but Sean Connery was the tougher, more serious agent, and a tremendous success with audiences of the 1960s. The odds were against him, though, and he was referred to at that time by American film executives as, quote, "the truck driver," unquote, probably because he had driven a truck at one time in his native Edinburgh. But Broccoli was especially impressed by Connery's stature and the fact that for a big man he moved like a cat. For Broccoli, Bond had to be an Englishman who was good with his fists, a combination he could sell to U.S. film audiences. When Connery was eventually signed to a 7-year contract, he underwent a transformation thanks to director Terence Young. Having grown up in the slums of Edinburgh, the very rugged and wild Connery was hardly Fleming's dashing upper-class hero. Young brought him to his own tailor and carefully outfitted him for the role of Bond. Connery may not have been Fleming's prototypical 007, but from the fans' point of view, and there would soon be millions, he was the best possible choice for the film series. Serious, sexy, deadly, and unbeatable, he was also extremely glib with writer Richard Maybaum's throwaway humor, a factor that contributed to the series' long-standing success. To date, Sean Connery has appeared in 7 James Bond movies: Dr. No, From Russia with Love, Goldfinger, Thunderball, You Only Live Twice, Diamonds Are Forever, and in 1983, the Thunderball remake, which was titled Never Say Never Again, a film that became a huge success even though it wasn't produced by Albert Broccoli.
I've done so much helicopter shooting. I shot all the helicopter chase in You Only Live Twice, and I'm afraid we lost the rotary arm, went through the foot of our cameraman.
And for a long while, he eventually lost his foot, I'm afraid. They had to amputate it after a lot of trying to keep it. Helicopter shooting is very dangerous and very difficult at times, because you can't manipulate, you can't really hold. Helicopters are so dependent on wind movements, and you cannot be specific about points, where they're going to go and what they're going to do. Because if the wind takes them suddenly on a gust, they move and they'll crash into something.
Helicopters, indeed, are featured in nearly every James Bond film. These sequences were filmed in Lochilphead, Scotland, and bear a strong resemblance to the crop-dusting plane scene in Alfred Hitchcock's 1959 classic North by Northwest, as Terence Young will point out shortly.
You asked me earlier on about Sean and doing stunts and what have you. He did that. A lot of that stuff was done by Sean himself.
This was my idea. It was a steal, of course, from Hitchcock, North by Northwest. Damn near hit Sean a couple of times, because, you know, a helicopter is not like a plane. You pull the thing, but it doesn't operate for nearly half a second. There's a delay between the transmission of the... it's not like steering a car and avoiding somebody by half an inch.
Whether it's borrowed or not, it's still a terrific action sequence that became the centerpiece of the film's trailer advertising campaign. It's also the perfect example of the man versus machine confrontation that was a salient element of all the early 007 films. If you asked most viewers of the film what sequence they best remembered from Russia with Love, chances are it would either be the train fight sequence or this helicopter chase.
That's real. He fires at him. That's a bit of me shooting something on the stage. That's a model. That's the model, Louis. That's model. On a string, actually, if you looked at it. That's model. That's on the ground. Bit of old set, perhaps. Piece of the model and whatever else. So you didn't actually see the impact. A clever little piece of work. You didn't actually see the impact. So we built a piece of helicopter. That's back projection.
I'd say one of the aircraft is missing.
What had happened was we were on the dockside with the whole crew waiting to go out on location. It was raining. But in Scotland, it was one of these strange things. The island over there was in sunlight and we were in the rain. So I said to my art director, the assistant art director, come along with me, we'll see what we need over there. And I went with the pilot. And the pilot, as we were taking off, he said, you've got to put on your Mae Wests. And I said, why? Because flying over water, it's a Ministry of Aviation law. I said, oh shit, I'm a good sailor, don't worry. And I just slung it over my arm, otherwise I'd be dead. He was showing off, and he took off backwards, and he got to about 100 feet and was making a very glamorous departure from the dockside, and he got about that far away from the shore, and something conked out in the engine, and we just went warm like that. We were underwater for about 30 seconds, still able to breathe because the canopy wasn't filling with water, and it slowly was filling up like this, and this guy couldn't swim. Nobody seemed to be able to swim in this bloody picture. The art director, I forgot to tell you, we had a camera mount on one side of the machine because it was our camera car, one of our camera helicopters. And just before we took off, he said, I better warn you, if there is a crash at sea, I have to turn the helicopter on its side. I said, why? He said, because if you're underwater and you come up and the chopper's still going, it'll take your head off. I said, okay, well, you turn it inside. And at that moment, I looked and I could see that we couldn't open the door on my side because the camera was mounting was there. So I said, you turn it over on this side. And we all had a terrific giggle. We then took off, and sure enough, it's exactly what happened. He managed to swing the thing over. And we landed not quite like that, but on that kind of an angle against something. I don't know how, something must have broken. There we were like this. The art director was a bright kid assistant art director, and he got out. He never came under the water. As the thing hit the water, it stayed there for about 3 or 4 seconds. He got that door open and was out like a dose of salts. By now, we were in the water, and I was saying, and he kept saying, oh, God, swim, I can't swim. And I said, do I get up? So I took an enormous breath, and I did something very interesting. I made an awful lot of money at dinner parties in the next few years after that by saying I can hold my breath for 2 minutes. I'll tell you right now, I could have held my breath another minute under that water there the moment I knew I was going to get out, because I actually stopped on the way up with this chap, and that's why I practically killed him. I stopped about every 10 feet so I didn't get bubbles in the blood, because if you go straight up like that, you risk getting the bends. And I must have stopped 3 or 4 times on the way up. And my lungs were bursting, but I knew perfectly well I was going to survive, I was going to live. And I swear, I tell you now, I could have probably lasted another minute, because you have to. He, of course, was gulping water all this time, and I didn't know what to do, whether it was better to, you know. And I put my hand over my head. It was pretty awful. And we got up, and one of the stuntmen, and he's always had a job with me ever since, he was the only guy who had the wits to start swimming the moment he saw, nobody else thought of it. The others jumped in long after, and the stuntmen, about 4 or 5 of the stuntmen, swam out. And the moment we surfaced, they grabbed a hold of him, and they grabbed a hold of me, because I was practically dead. And I had 40-something stitches in my leg, and nothing above my knee. And when the divers went in the next day from the insurance company, all these... Oh, yes, what happened was, how we got out was the perspex exploded with a pressure. It went whang, like that. And we were sucked out of the thing. And I was totally untouched. I could have been blinded, smashed, gored to bits. The divers, the next day, wearing heavy rubber gloves, all cut their hands on the perspex. And I had all these stitches in both legs that were like that. I was a real mess. So they pulled us ashore. I was taken to hospital. And an hour later, Harry Saltzman was panicking very much, and they were trying to get David Lean was cutting Lawrence in the same building where they were, and they were asking David if he would take over and finish the sequence. And David said, yes, of course I will, if you want to. I know Terrence very well, I'll help him out, you know, I don't want screen credit like that, but I'll do 3 or 4 days. And Cubby said, hang on, Harry, he said, wait a minute, he called Bill Hill. And he said to Bill Hill, how's Terrence? And Bill Hill said, I don't know, but he's gone to hospital. And Cubby said, did he walk? And Bill said, yes, he did. He said, well, break for lunch, give them their lunch, you'll be shooting after lunch. And at 2 o'clock, we were back on the boat. The poor wretched pilot damn near died. He was in a very bad way.
The idea of skipping a Very pistol across gasoline drums was based on one of screenwriter Richard Maybaum's sequences in The Red Beret, in which a bazooka shell is used to pave the way for an escape route through a minefield.
And the burning water was mine. That was something that happened during the war. I was on maneuvers. I was in an armored division in a tank. And we were taken down one day to do a rehearsal of the landing in Normandy. And one of the objects that they'd given us that they said the Germans were going to do was to set fire to the sea. We'd had a report that they'd been putting oil things under the water. They did, but they ran out of oil. And we did a rehearsal where we had to drive our tank through the thing. And so that's why we used that stunt later.
It was a difficult sequence to shoot because of the elements of water. Boats and water are always very tricky. The actual location was up in Scotland. But the actual, this fire bit, so that we could control it, was down on the tank at Pinewood.
Now we're back in Venice, where Rosa Klebb is about to get her kicks. In the original novel, there was no helicopter or boat chase. The producers felt, and rightly so, that after the long and claustrophobic train fight, it was important to open up the film. The action in the book went directly from the Orient Express to Paris, where Klebb actually kicked Bond with one of her poisoned shoe knives, and it looked like the end for 007. Fleming was tired of the less than exciting book sales and was ready to kill off his agent once and for all. It was only through the intervention of American author Raymond Chandler that Fleming revived 007 in the next novel, Dr. No. From Russia with Love was also a big favorite of President John F. Kennedy. The fact that it was on his 1961 reading list, as reported by Life magazine correspondent Hugh Seide, was not only considered a publicity windfall for U.S. book sales, but it motivated United Artists to seriously consider the financing of a series of James Bond movies to be produced by Albert R. Broccoli and Harry Saltzman. Acting quickly, the UA executives signed a deal in New York which paved the way for Dr. No and all the other 007 classics. Ironically, Lotta Lenya's appearance in From Russia with Love brought her more public attention, perhaps, than all of her previous stage appearances in three decades combined.
That's Sean's frog look. I used to have to say to him, Sean Frog. He used to do this with his mouth. He wouldn't do it twice. Most times you didn't have to tell Sean.
From Russia with Love opened in the U.S. with little fanfare on May 27, 1964. Like Dr. No, it did not have a major publicized premiere and actually opened on a double feature with the B-film programmer War is Hell. It was only after the success of Goldfinger that Christmas that From Russia with Love was re-released on a double feature with Dr. No and became a major hit. In fact, it was the most successful double feature in history. Many people who missed From Russia with Love in first runs caught that double feature. The box office rental figure of $9.9 million for From Russia with Love presage the huge rental figures that would soon follow.
My sound man, John Mitchell, in this picture, used to go out in the morning and get effects before the town was moving. The birds, those pigeons, and the thing, I think he must have shot those bloody pigeons for about three mornings in a row at 5 o'clock, you know.
Yes, she's had her kicks.
Grand Canal. I shot this long after the picture was finished. And I think my wife was in the shot here just for what? But in three frames or something. It's rather bad back projection. There's no red in it. There was no sun, I think that's the problem. That's the famous Bridge of Sighs.
James, behave yourself. We are being filmed.
Like that's her with a red dress. It's her only screen appearance, I think. All of this we had to coke up because we didn't have an end again. So really it's a reprise of the Dr. No ending when you analyze it, you know. And now we hear that wonderful music from Russia with Love. Enough, that's too much, baby. Oh, that wasn't Sean, that was somebody else's hand, that's right. Sean wasn't there for that.
This Laserdisc commentary is dedicated to screenwriter Richard Maybaum, who completed his interview shortly before his death.
In case you'd say no, to Russia I flew, but there and then I suddenly knew you'd care again. To you from Russia with